Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Reynolds v. Johnson. Mr. Krueger.
Good morning, and may it please the court. This is the appeal of Jim Reynolds. Jim Reynolds was an employee of the General Services Administration, the people who just happened to manage the building we're in this morning.
We're well aware of that.
At the time of his cause of action, he was 62 years old and he had 30 years of service with the GSA. His last day worked with the GSA was only last month, August 3rd. Reynolds, as a federal employee, was confined to the procedures of the internal EEO procedures of a federal agency. Those are contained in the CFR. Thus, Reynolds had to fill out a form to make his EEO allegation. In using that form, he only had a very small place to write a narrative of his charge. In that narrative,
the form did contain a series of boxes to check, didn't it?
That's correct, and it is a mystery to me why the retaliation box seems to be blacked out in that copy that I have. But I can say that in the narrative, Reynolds stated that he complained of harassment due whistleblowing and an environment of harassment. And thus, appellate submits that the charge, fairly read, would encompass a hostile environment claim. The EEO refused to accept Reynolds' retaliation claim, despite the fact that Reynolds made multiple efforts to communicate. When they asked for specific dates, again, appellate would submit that this was, first of all, not fully discerning a hostile environment claim, and second of all, asking for specific dates would really go to the investigation of a charge and not the acceptance of a charge, because at 29 CFR 1614.105, it states that the counselor shall not attempt to restrain an aggrieved person from making a charge. So they certainly could have accepted the charge and then found that there was insufficient evidence to support it. So we point out that he exhausted his remedies by virtue of the standard in Rush v. McDonald's, that he brought it to the attention. Rush v. McDonald's states that it's not the charges actually investigated, but the charges brought to the attention. Further, Reynolds had a history of protected activity, and his retaliation claim is reasonably related to his age claim that encompasses the same persons. So our first error is that we ask you find the trial court erred by dismissing his retaliation claim at summary judgment and allow him to proceed on the retaliation claim. Second, we ask that the court adopt a holding in Ford v. Mavis and hold that the sweeping language and unambiguous language of Section 633A of the Federal Sector Age Discrimination Employment Act establishes a different standard of causation in federal sector cases and allows for a limited recovery if a federal sector plaintiff proves that age was a factor in his non-promotion. As the statute states in relevant portions, that all personnel actions shall be made free from any discrimination based on age. Continuing on 633A, this court shall also find, as a matter of law, that the appellee GSA's refusal to interview applicants, and they're implicating as a rationale the collective bargaining provision found at Section 10B of the collective bargaining agreement, constitutes a personnel action, as that term is used in 633A. It says all personnel actions. By failing to interview four persons in the protected age category, the collective bargaining agreement was invoked as a rationale to exclude four persons in a protected category while allowing the decision maker to summarily promote his subordinate. Given that the subordinate had virtually unlimited access to the GSA decision maker.
Counsel, I'm going to interrupt for a minute. You skipped over pretty quickly the important interpretive issue.
And the interpretive issue being the mixed motive theory and the availability of limited recovery, Your Honor?
Well, what the meaning of 633A is.
The meaning
what
of six?
What the legal standard for those claims is, whether it differs from standard
it differs,
cases against private employers.
It differs in that it does not require but for causation, because all personnel actions must be made free from any discrimination based on age.
Well, that focuses on one part of the text of the statute, but it doesn't read it as a whole. An employment discrimination free from any discrimination based on age is a, you know, a claim that the decision in question was made based on age. In other words, the different treatment. That's what discrimination
is. Yes. Yes, I understand. And I think I understand. The trial court used a but-for. If all things were the same except the age.
But before we get, I mean, the trial court kind of covered its bases, I think, recognizing that there's a little confusion here in terms of what the statute means, because there is no precedent in this circuit interpreting this statute.
Yes.
So he kind of used a couple of different standards to make sure that the waterfront was covered. So let's put that to one side for a moment and focus on the interpretive question. The statute requires that all personnel actions by the federal government shall be made free from any discrimination based on age. Discrimination is different treatment, and so that focuses on the decision being made, the employment decision being made.
Yes.
And suggest that but-for causation is required. The D.C. Circuit didn't see it that way, but I question whether that's a correct interpretation of the statute.
Well, clearly, we contend that the mixed motive and limited recovery should be available to a federal sector plaintiff based on that broad language and the fact that
the statute doesn't say that employment actions should be made free from bias. Says free from discrimination based on age. And it seems to me that the D.C. Circuit's decision reads the statute as if it said that employment actions or personnel actions shall be made free from bias as opposed to discrimination. Discrimination is different treatment. So that focuses on the decision in question, the employment decision in question, and requires that decision be made free from age discrimination. In other words, the differential in treatment has to be causally related in a but-for kind of way to the plaintiff's age.
Well, I suppose we're following, we're contending that Ford was decided correctly. And Ford found that.
I'm asking you why.
Pardon me?
I'm asking you why.
Because of the different language. Because of the different wording. When these decisions were made to eliminate mixed motive, it focused on the unambiguous wording of the statutes, of the various statutes. And it said that the ADA and the Age Discrimination Act, because their language varied with Title VII, were not entitled to a plaintiff that showed that discrimination was a motive, but maybe not the tipping point. Obviously, we're trying to put human motivation on a scale here and weigh it, so that's very hard, isn't it?
But maybe it said I can get at this a different way.
Right, maybe.
The D.C. Circuit's interpretation of this statute reads it as an anti-bias statute. In other words, a statute that attempts to eradicate a biased state of mind, as opposed to an anti-discrimination statute, which is a statute that gets at differential treatment, disparate treatment. In other words, focuses in on the employment decision being made and the determination of whether that decision was made on account of or because of age. And so it impermissibly broadened the scope of this statute.
Right.
I
understand that. I understand that would be a contention raised by Appellee, and I would counter to say that it says any personnel action So that is an action. It's not just a bias. It means that an action has to be free from choices. I guess discrimination is if I go to a wine rack and I choose a different wine, I'm discriminating between one wine and another. That's a choice. So there was a choice. There were choices made. There was personnel action. There were choices made. There was a choice made to not interview people. Four of those people, every person besides the person selected, were in a protected category. And someone made a decision, discriminated, and said, I'm going to take this bottle of wine and I'm going to forget the other four, the old bottles of wine, and I'm going to summarily select this. So given that the federal statute says all personnel actions free of discrimination, these are very broad terms. So perhaps it is an anti-bias. I hadn't conceptualized it as such. I just looked at it as authorizing a mixed motive meaning. For lack of a better reading, the amendments to Title VII that say if you find there's an impermissible motive, regardless of whether it tips the scale, it's still a violation of the law. So, first, we argue there's a mixed motive recovery authorized under that language. Next, we argue that the failure to interview is a personnel action. And it says all personnel actions. It doesn't just say hire, fire, terms of condition, terms, conditions, etc. It says all personnel actions.
Even if your mixed motive interpretation of the statute is correct, in other words, that Ford versus Mabus was correct, and we ought to adopt that interpretation of the statute here, the D.C. Circuit narrowly circumscribed the remedy.
It would be the remedy that's in 42 U.S.C. 2000E5G2. It would be the limited recovery and injunctive declaratory relief for lack that would be borrowed from Title VII.
Which, in this case, would mean what?
It would mean that Reynolds would recover his attorney's fees and costs, and the agency would be enjoined from the same practice. And I do have a case that I wanted to mention called Nichols v. SEIU Edwardsville. In Nichols versus SEIU Edwardsville, this circuit held that being placed on administrative leave was not a materially adverse action. And that's under Title VII, and that may be the case. But is being placed on administrative leave not a personnel action? I would submit that it is. And so had that occurred in the federal sector, that would have been actionable, and that would have been adverse, sufficiently adverse, to allow the limited recovery that we're urging in this matter. So I hope I've addressed your questions. So even if this court is not persuaded that Reynolds showed that age was a factor, it should nevertheless remand the age count because the trial court erred by failing to shift the burden to the appellee as required under Meacham versus Knowles Atomic Laboratory to show that the interview provision in the collective bargaining agreement was raised as an affirmative defense. The Age Act contains enumerated affirmative defenses at 623F. This includes a reasonable factor other than age and includes a bona fide collective bargaining, bona fide seniority system. The court should have shifted the burden to the GSA to show, as listed, 29 CFR tells us what a bona fide seniority system is under the Age Act. It says it must be based on length of service as the primary criterion for the equitable allocation of available employment opportunities and prerogatives. I like the term prerogatives because it was repeated early and often in this case that the GSA had the prerogative to forego interviewing people. And even if that resulted in a de facto exclusion of four people in a protected age category and a summary promotion of a 32-year-old applicant. So we would urge that this court remand this, well, first that this court would find that we had shown that age was a factor in a personnel action, that you hold that the collective bargaining agreement was raised as an affirmative defense, and award limited recovery to appellant.
Thank you, Scroover.
Thank you so much.
Ms. Peluso.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, in this case, there was a trial regarding why Mr. Reynolds wasn't selected for the position at issue here. And the court found that he wasn't selected because he wasn't considered the best candidate. The selectee, Mr. Bell, was considered to have better interpersonal skills, had more experience with tenant relationships, had more experience in maintenance. Mr. Reynolds was found not to have the interpersonal skills required for the position. Importantly, the district court found that there was no evidence presented at trial that age was a factor or consideration in the selection at issue here. To address briefly the standard that was applied by the district court, I think the district court did apply several different legal standards to give Mr. Reynolds an opportunity to prevail under several different theories. But with regard to the decision of Ford versus Mavis, which we focused on a bit in the D.C. Circuit, in that case, the D.C. Circuit looked to the language of the provision of the ADEA that applies specifically to federal employees and found that it may allow for some limited relief. But importantly, there in the district court found that the selection at issue was tinged with considerations of age. So the D.C. Circuit remanded to the district court to decide if, under a more lenient standard, if the plaintiff would have prevailed there. In this case, there's no evidence that the decision was tinged with any considerations of age. In fact, the district court found the opposite. So therefore, even if the Ford versus Mavis standard did apply, which we would argue it does not, it wouldn't have made any material difference to the decision of the district court and wouldn't justify a remand of the age discrimination case for a consideration under those standards.
So your position is that the D.C. Circuit got the statute wrong?
Correct. The language in the 633A is very similar, actually, to the language in the ADEA provision at 629, in that 629 says because of age, and 633A says based on age. And the Supreme Court in the Gross decision held that that because of age in 629 indicated a heightened standard in age cases because the ADEA was not amended in the Civil Rights Act of 1991 to provide for a mixed motive analysis. I would submit that 633A doesn't have significantly different language that would allow us to interpret it much differently than the way that the private sector provisions within the Age Discrimination Act are interpreted. Additionally, the Seventh Circuit pattern jury instruction uses language that's very similar to the but-for causation, in that the Seventh Circuit jury instruction says that had all other factors been the same, but the person was younger or outside of the protected class, would the same decision have been made? That was also a standard that the district court did apply in this case. And the evidence in this case showed that the decision maker said, had everything else been the same, but Mr. Reynolds had been under 40, the exact same selection would have been made. So we would submit that the ADEA does have heightened language as compared to Title VII, as the Supreme Court stated in Gross, and that that shouldn't necessarily apply different to the federal sector.
Well, the two statutes are worded differently. One is in the passive voice and the other is in the active voice. And the passive voice construction of 633A, the federal employer anti-discrimination statute, does have this, what the D.C. Circuit called, sweeping language about all personnel actions being free from discrimination based on age.
Right.
So the language is
different. And I suppose that could be read to show a difference in the intent of the statute with regard to federal employees. But I think the important fact is that in this case, even if we were to say that that language within 633A does allow for a more lenient standard of review.
I understand, this case might not cut it either way.
Right.
I'm concerned about the proper interpretation of the statute. And it seems to me very clear that based on age means the same thing as because of age, and that the proper locus of inquiry here is on what it means to discriminate in personnel actions, and that means to treat employees differently. And nobody, it seems to me, has focused on that, not the D.C. Circuit nor anybody in this case.
Yes, I would agree that that has not been briefed by the parties in this case, and that wasn't the focus of analysis in the D.C. Circuit.
So should it be the focus?
In this case, I don't think that it's a necessary inquiry for the parties to engage in, given that the standard wouldn't make any difference to the trial court findings here.
Right, but we do want to get the law right.
Right. Right. I think I did research whether other circuits had addressed this issue after the Gross decision. It looks as though the D.C. Circuit in Ford versus Mavis at least had the most extensive discussion of the difference in the language of the statutes. I found some cases in other circuits where the Gross standard did apply to federal circuit employment cases, but without the sort of sweeping analysis of the difference between the two languages of the statutes. So it's an inquiry that I haven't given much thought to in terms of the question that Your Honor poses, and I'm not necessarily prepared to give an answer to it now. But I do think that it is important that we remember that in this case the district court did apply several tests. As Your Honor pointed out, he sort of covered his bases with the legal analysis here. I would like to just talk briefly about one of the points that was raised by the appellant during his argument regarding the shifting of the burden if an exemption under the ADEA is invoked. Those exemptions, the Meacham Court in the Supreme Court, as well as the Smith decision in the Supreme Court, said that those exemptions really apply to a desperate impact case where the ADEA has been violated in some way. Sections A through C have been violated, and then that exemption comes in. In a disparate treatment case, those exemptions don't really apply because if the decision was based on a reasonable factor other than age in a disparate treatment case, you never get to the exemptions in the first place. So I think the Meacham and the Smith decisions that are relied on by Mr. Reynolds are inappropriate in that this is a disparate impact and not, or disparate treatment rather, than a disparate impact case. With regard to the retaliation claim that was dismissed at summary judgment, that claim was dismissed for failure to exhaust. Mr. Reynolds points out that in his administrative complaint, he says that he was subject to an environment of harassment / whistleblowing, but when he was asked by the investigator to provide details regarding that claim, he failed to do so. He was asked several times to provide dates or details. He indicated he had some documents that may support his claims, but he never provided them to the investigator, never really giving the agency the opportunity to adjudicate administratively that portion of his complaint. So it was he failed to cooperate with the EEO investigator, and in the district court and before this court, he excuses that behavior, saying it would be futile to have continued to have cooperated with the investigator. There's no evidence that futility here would have, or that his, cooperation would have resulted in futility, because it looked as though the investigator was trying to give him the opportunity to present that portion of his complaint administratively. But even if that claim had been exhausted, there's no evidence that it would have been successful on the merits. With regard to the non-selection at issue before this court, Mr. Reynolds was given a trial on that case, and again, he was found to be the lesser of the two in terms of qualifications for the position. So there's no evidence that the decision would have been different had he not engaged in protected activity. There's also no evidence that the decision makers were aware of any of his protected activity or that similarly situated employees did not engage in protected activity. Accordingly, we would submit that the retaliation claim was not only not exhausted, but would fail on its merits at a de novo review, and therefore that claim shouldn't be remanded. If Your Honors have nothing further, no further questions, I would ask that you affirm the decisions of the district court.
Thank you, Ms. Pelosi.
Thank you.
Mr. Krueger, your time had expired, but I'll give you an additional 2 minutes.
I have to respectfully disagree. When I hear based on, I hear that there's a role for age. When I hear because of, I hear a determination. So I got to respectfully disagree.
You want to speak, Mr. Krueger, a little bit to the government's position that on the retaliation claim, there just was an absence of cooperation?
It's just not the case. If you review the record, the appellant sent 3 or 4 emails. The first acceptance letter sent by the EEO said this was not discussed with the counselor. And the counselor's notes, her name is Davis, flatly contradict that. It says, yes, he discussed reprisal and harassment. He gets an acceptance letter saying, we're not taking this claim because it wasn't discussed with the counselor. It's just flatly contradicted in the record, Your Honor, in a document.
No, I'm not speaking so much to a broad statement that harassment occurred. I'm speaking to whether or not any specificity was advanced with regard to that claim.
They asked for specific dates. He gave specific occurrences, Your Honor. This would normally be enough to be accepted for investigation. And again, I think it's totally different accepting something versus whether you proceed or whether you find substantial evidence or whether you find merit in something. There's a CFR provision that says the counselor will not attempt to restrain an aggrieved party for filing it. Clearly, if you read this email string and these acceptance letters, there's restraint. So I think, in terms of fighting City Hall, he sent a number over a three-week period, sent three emails, received four letters, and in the end his claim was rejected. And the claim, fairly read, really is a hostile environment claim, so how are you giving specific dates? There's going to be innumerable incidents, and they cited the 45-day limit. So they misapplied Morgan v. Amtrak. He can talk about previous events in a hostile environment claim. So that's my response to that, Your Honor. I refer to Finnegan versus Transworld Airlines. It talks about disparate impact and about how Smith says the ADA goes to the consequences and just not the motivation of the act. And surely we showed that there were consequences.
Thank you, Mr. Kruger.
Thank you so much.
Thank you to all counsel. The case is taken under